For years, journalists like me have been wondering what UW-Madison political science professor Kathy Kramer learned as she visited restaurants, diners, coffee shops, and barns, listening to the people of Wisconsin. Well, now we know. Her book, The Politics of Resentment, Rural Consciousness in Wisconsin and the Rise of Scott Walker, is now out. So I want to thank Professor Kathy Kramer, also director of the Mortgage Center on Public Service, for talking to us about your book.
Thank you for talking with me.
Let's talk about the methodology, which I find intriguing. Sure. So you set off for Madison in your Jetta, and you go into these rural settings. No, they weren't all rural, but
right.
I think your biggest finding is the rural consciousness.
Right.
So that took you out of this office and your classroom comfort zone. How was that for you?
A little nerve-wracking and really wonderful, honestly. I'm a bit of a shy person, so just walking into a gas station and finding the morning coffee clutch and introducing myself took a little bit of gumption, which isn't sort of my normal personality. So, you know, it was a little bit hard. But honestly, once I did introduce myself, spending time with these groups around the state was truly delightful. Much of what they were telling me was difficult to hear and a little troubling, but I had a great time, to be honest.
Yeah, you say on 28 and 29, this research was personal. I got to know people. They asked to see pictures of my daughter. I asked to see pictures of their families in return. I got manure on my toes. I got insulted, and I got and gave hugs. I had to find a way to be authentic, be myself. Why was that so important, Professor?
Because I don't think they would have talked to me otherwise. I think people in general can, well, usually sense BS when they hear it or see it, right? And if you walk into a group of people they're a group of friends and they've been spending time for years, and you walk in and you say, "Hi, can I join you this morning?" Why would they give you the time of day if it seems like you want to sell them something, or you want to tell them what they have wrong, or you want to tell them a different way of living? I think they would have just booted me from their groups pretty quickly. But instead, you know, just being me and just genuinely saying, "I'm really interested in what you think," went a long way toward people welcoming me in and talking with me.
Just one more on the methodology. I was
sure.
Struck. The one place you went in and you didn't see the traditional coffee clutch, so a local attorney had to take back a curtain and get you into the dice game.
Yeah.
Were the dice game recipients surprised?
I think so. And to be honest, I was just with them this past Monday morning to hand deliver a copy of my book. I've been wanting to get up there for a few weeks now. And another patron in the diner, so this is a place where, you know, it's a wonderful local hangout, and then there's this dice game going on in the back room every day. And for this group, there are not many women who join this group. I'm not sure if there are any ever. And so people in the restaurant saw me walking back to the restaurant, and this fella came in later. He said, "I just want to know what's going on in here because she walked in here like she owned the place." I thought, well, that's not good. I hope I didn't. But people were bewildered in the restaurant. So I think the group members themselves thought I was a little bit nuts the first time I walked in there, for sure.
I admire the scope of your research. No, I admire the window of your research. You started listening in 2007 and ended in November of 2012?
Right, and I've been back a few times between then to some of the groups, yeah.
But that is a period of span in Wisconsin political history that spanned the end of the Jim Doyle administration, the election of Scott Walker, the Great Recession, Governor Walker survives a recall, and then he's reelected. Right. Why did you decide on a five-year window, Professor?
Well, it was serendipity that I was doing this field work when the 2010, or I should say, I knew the 2010 gubernatorial election was coming up, but I didn't anticipate Scott Walker getting elected and sort of the ensuing turmoil and very intense politics that we witnessed here in the state. So I was wrapping up my field work about 2009, mid-2010, but then when that election ramped up and Scott Walker got elected and, you know, Act 10 protests at the Capitol, I thought, there's a lot more to learn here, and I want to get back out there and visit with these folks and see what they're thinking.
Well, let's talk about real consciousness, which I think is the heart of your book's finding. You define that real consciousness, a strong sense of identity as a real person, combined with a strong sense that rural areas are the victims of injustice, the sense that rural folks do not get a fair share of power, respect, or resources, and that rural folks prefer lifestyles that differ fundamentally from those of city people. Your book seems to indicate you were surprised by the depth of this passion. Is passion the right word? Is anger? What's the best term?
Well, I say resentment, right? Because sometimes it's anger, a lot of times it's passion, but I call it resentment because it's sort of this undertone to a lot of different attitudes and perceptions and sentiments. And, you know, it's this feeling of, for a long time, being on the short end of the stick and nobody hearing that or responding to it. So for me, resentment seemed to capture it really well.
Was the resentment bigger in 2012 than in 2007? Had it grown in a major way, Professor?
I don't know if it grew, but I saw within these groups that it gained an intensity, I would say. So, you know, when I first met these folks in 2007 or 2008, and here I'm talking about most of the, you know, the rural groups or the smaller community groups, they readily talked to me about their resentment towards public employees or people in the city. But then when, after Act 10, what happened, as happened for many of us, is politics became very personal. And so within these groups, there were people who were public employees themselves or were married to a public employee. And so the resentment was there. So I'm not sure it grew, but it definitely became more intense and became so intense in some cases that people just stopped talking to each other or spending time in these groups that were a part of their everyday life for years.
Well, you mentioned Governor, when he was a candidate for governor in 2010, Governor Walker used the term haves and have-nots.
Right.
Is that a fair description? Did many of the rural people you interviewed feel like the have-nots?
Yeah, for sure. Right. And it's a little bit surprising for people in the Madison and Milwaukee metro areas to hear that. But in many of these smaller communities in Wisconsin, I both encountered that perception that public employees are the haves and private employees are the have-nots. But when you look at the data in smaller communities in the state, that often happens to be the case, often where public employees are the ones with the relatively higher salaries and the ones with benefits, pensions, and health care insurance. Whereas when you get in the metro areas, the reverse is true. So it's people, you know, the higher incomes tend to come with private sector jobs.
There's a few words that I want to ask you to explain. The concept of place.
What does
place mean in terms of the interviews you did?
Yeah, for me, place, you can look at almost any electoral map, whether it's Wisconsin, national, even internationally, and there's often some correspondence between where people live and how they vote or which party or which candidate they support. But for me, place is more a part of a perspective that many people in these rural areas used to think about politics, used to think about many issues, but it's not just a correlation between, say, Republican Party support and rural communities, but instead people talked about themselves as people from a certain type of place. Yes. And people from a certain type of place who have this understanding of an unfair distribution of resources. So for me, place is like, for many people, it's core to our identity.
What about the term class?
Yeah, well, it's in there too. And for me, the fascinating thing about social class for me is not the empirical or objective evidence about people's income level or their occupation or their level of education, but how they see themselves in the kind of the status rank order of people, right? So if you go to go back to the public versus private employee example, if you go to one community, a smaller community, and the public school teachers are the upper crust, right? You come to Madison at the time of Act 10, that certainly was not the perception, right? So class is kind of fluid in, and what we think of it, depending on where we are a lot of times. And it's often intertwined with place. So in these conversations, I often heard people in outstate Wisconsin talk about themselves and their communities as sort of being on, you know, the short end of the stick, or having less than other people in other places in the state.
Well, in terms of those in rural areas you interviewed, talk to me about race. Yeah. How much did race matter, please, Professor?
A lot and not at all. So here's what I mean, that it very rarely did people in conversations talk about people of color, racial minorities of any background. It did come up, for sure. In outstate Wisconsin, it most often came up around Native American communities, and, you know, often in not a very positive way. When Obama was running for president in 2008, race was a big topic. People, as with almost every time it came up, people were uncomfortable talking about race when I would probe further. But it's not necessarily the case that it wasn't often the case. So when people were talking about those people in the city, they weren't necessarily talking about racial minorities. They were often talking about the liberal elite, me, you know, and they were clear. They're talking about me, you know, how is it that you can be driving around the state?
In a barn, there's a dairy farmer who looks at you and said, I'm glad Walker finally took something away from those bastards. And you say,
yes.
He was referring to people like you.
Yeah, he was referring to me, right. So, you know, this resentment toward the cities, it's partly about racial minorities. And so it's definitely in there, but there's a lot of other things to it. And so when I say there wasn't much talk about race and yet there was a lot, anytime we're talking about who's getting their fair share in this country, race is a part of it, because that debate has always been something about race from, you know, shortly after the Civil War, when the federal government was suddenly quite large and had resources to distribute. Race was invoked, racism was invoked to try to get people to, you know, favor reallocation resources or not. And so even when we're not talking about it explicitly, it is part of the issue. And especially when we're talking about who's deserving and who is not, often, you know, there's coded language in there about who in the population is deserving, who's lazy, who's working hard.
I want to ask you how the values of rural consciousness is transmitted using this quote. In these narratives in the rural areas, people are telling each other that there are people that do not value what we value, do not work as hard as we do, and are actively sucking away the livelihoods we have worked so hard to create. Here's my question. You and your research assistant studied newspaper articles for years, and you found that these rural consciousness values, the haves and have-nots, were not subject of news coverage. How are these values transmitted, Professor?
I think just we teach them to each other. I think in conversations, in the home, in friend groups, in workplaces, you know, the way they were taught to me, really, sometimes in jokes, sometimes in stories, you know, examples of the time I didn't get my fair share, or, you know, I was just down in Milwaukee and you should see all the building going on when here, you know, look at our main street, it's all boarded up. You know, people in like brief comments or longer stories, people teach these attitudes to each other.
Let's talk about the April 5 primary. You've seen the map.
Yeah.
Donald Trump took the 3rd and 7th congressional districts. That indicates, and Mr. Cruz took the other 6 congressional districts. I'm tempted to say that you found Donald Trump voters before the Trump campaign. Did you?
I guess so. And I say I guess so because I often joke, I would love to say that I saw Donald Trump coming years ago. You know, this is not true. But that map does make sense to me in the sense that Cruz did well in the more metro areas of the state. I mean, exceptions, so La Crosse, Eau Claire, not in that Cruz territory, right? But the parts where Donald Trump did well tend to be, you know, much more rural than the Cruz portions of the state. And definitely the attitudes that I heard, you can see Donald Trump tapping into that, you know, claiming, like, you're not getting your fair share, you're right, and you deserve more, and, you know, we need to get back to the way things used to be. And that all that rhetoric, as well as sort of pointing the finger of blame at certain population groups, that's very much in Donald Trump's playbook.
Based on your 89 listening sessions, let me ask you this. What role do the terms Republican and Democrat play in the rural areas?
Yeah.
Because you say, we see politicians tapping into divides and nourishing resentment, and then claiming that electoral support is evidence that the public has a principled stance on the role of government. That's on page 220. What role do labels now play, Republicans and Democrats?
They do play some role, right? And the way I'm talking about these rural communities, much of what I heard was more in the along the lines of support for the Republican Party. But there are definitely people who are leaning toward the Democratic Party in our more rural counties in the state, right? So everything I'm saying, keep in mind that, you know, it's not what I got was in-depth information about how people piece certain things together. It's not necessarily representative of everybody in the state, right? So having said that, I mean, the labels still matter, and there are people leaning toward the Republican Party as there are people leaning toward the Democratic Party. But what really surprised me was the fact that very few people wanted to say that they were strong partisans in either direction. So when I would ask people, which party do you think best represents people around here? People, without skipping a beat, almost always would say, neither party, you know?
None of the above.
Yeah, none of the above. Neither party. Neither of them is listening to us, cares about what's going on here. And that was really eye-opening to me. So at the same time, partisan labels still matter. There is room for some major shifts to go on in the outstate part of the state, because in my mind, what that said to me is the candidate who can go into these communities and say and convince people, you know, I care about what's going on here, I hear what you're saying, and I'm going to do something about it, and then actually do something about it to improve people's standard of living, has a lot of potential to garner huge support.
You make a point of saying in the book that Governor Walker did not create this urban-rural divide, but then you say, Walker not only made the most of the Great Recession, he also tapped into rural consciousness. Walker's proposals were not necessarily a victory for smaller government. They were a victory for small-town Wisconsinites like themselves, those people in rural areas.
Right.
Does Governor Walker owe rural people thanks for the for his elections of 2010, 2012, 2014, Professor?
Yes. I think, I mean, the Milwaukee suburban communities are a huge source of support for Governor Walker.
But they're offset by the Dane and Milwaukee Democratic power bases, excuse me.
Yes, and but in he was very strongly supported in the smaller communities around the state. And people very much perceived that here was a person who was standing up for them as opposed to people, as opposed to the liberal elite. I mean, Governor Walker never said liberal elite in his campaign.
But he used haves and have-nots.
Yes, he did.
I'm so struck by the animus that some of the rural residents that you showed for public employees, because it included public school teachers who may be teaching their grandchildren and children. Were you surprised that public employees included the teacher in the local public elementary high school just down the road?
Yes and no. I mean, both of my parents were public school teachers. And so I've seen across the course of my lifetime both the deep respect that people have to public school teachers and also some of the resentment about those folks having a really great job, right? I mean, they get their summers off coming along with this perception that somehow they don't work very hard, you know. So I feel as though on a personal level I've seen that, but it's still eye opening when people who have been public school teachers in a community for decades still perceive that they are treated as outsiders and somewhat apart from the rest of the community.
One quote in your book that really sticks with me, you were quoting a rural resident as saying, public employees, quote, shower before work and not after.
Yeah.
Meaning they don't work as hard in terms of manual labor as we do up north.
Yeah, that's such a striking kind of shorthand for a lot of these sentiments. The first time someone asked me that, you know, so Kathy, just tell us, when do you take a shower? You know, and I said, well, I take a shower before work. And they said, see? And it was their way of saying, like, we work so hard during the day that we have to shower first thing when we come home, you know, because we've sweat, we're dirty, it's physical labor. And that's not, you know, exclusive to Wisconsin, the equating physical labor with really hard work. It's part of a broader cultural divide in our country, and even more globally than that, where people who, you know, this so-called knowledge economy, those of us who sit behind a desk mm-hmm. most of the day, how is that hard work? You know, it's just not perceived as hard work to many people.
When you set out on your research, the UW-Madison said, we want you to ask about how we, the UW-Madison, is perceived out there.
Yeah.
You indicate in your book you were surprised at the animus, I'll use that term again, at the UW-Madison. Why?
Partly because of where I grew up, I think, and my own personal background. So my dad was a high school football coach in Grafton, Wisconsin, very successful high school football coach, and football has been a huge part of my life, my entire life. And Badger sports have been a huge thing in my life. And
you so handed out football schedules.
I did, right.
As a way to
really appreciate it, right? So my sense for much of my upbringing was people love the University of Wisconsin-Madison, partly because of Badger sports. But also my sense, I mean, where I grew up in Grafton, Wisconsin, my sense was that if you were really fortunate, you got to go to UW-Madison, right? If you worked really hard and were a good student, you maybe got to go. And I got to go. And so, you know, and coming here changed my life, you know, opened my mind to so many things. I had such a fabulous experience here. And then lo and behold, when I got my PhD, a job was open here, and I've been a faculty member here ever since. So my love for this institution is very, very deep. And I have a sense that it is this great resource in this state where kids like me can go and launch into just a fabulous life, you know, a fascinating, challenging, rewarding life. So going out into outstate Wisconsin and encountering people in Badger gear who, you know, then said, well, faculty, you know, you're lazy, you're all liberal,
you get summers
you're all
off.
Elitist, right. It was hard to take at first, but you know, I recognized pretty quickly that this is my job here, to listen to this and understand it as best I can, because wow, this is widespread and it's pretty intense feeling, both the pride in the university and wanting to have more connection to it.
But you know? Found a perception that the UW-Madison, we're talking about a perception, that the UW-Madison didn't want to educate the rural graduates of our high schools, number one, and that the families in rural Wisconsin couldn't afford to pay the tuition.
Right.
So, yes, they love the football team, and they can tell you, you know, the record of the basketball team and all that, but there's this deep underlying, they don't want our children down at UW-Madison, correct?
Yeah. That is the perception I heard, but you probably can see my face kind of fall as you talk about it. It's so sad to me, because it's not the reality here. I mean, and I say that just as a member of the university community and, you know, as an instructor, as a faculty member, the notion that I might not want those students, that I might not want to have time with those students, just, I don't experience that, and I don't experience it in my friends, my colleagues here on campus. And I know, you know, I could go on and on about how in reality I don't think that's the case, but yes, that perception was out there, and it's really unfortunate.
Let me ask you this. After years of listening and thinking about what you heard, are the concerns haves and have-nots? We're in rural Wisconsin, we're a have-not, and public employees, including UW-Madison employees, are the haves.
Yeah.
Are they justified? Because some of those people at the dice game and your loggers group didn't have defined benefit pensions.
Right.
Aren't able to convert their sick leave when they retire.
Mm-hmm.
Are some of those concerns justified?
Depends what you mean by justified, right? Such a
Do they have valid concerns? Is there really there is an economic disparity, isn't there?
There absolutely is. Yes, and yes, if only people. I mean, I have great healthcare benefits for which I am so thankful. Having gone through a pregnancy, having a child, and when my daughter having to have been hospitalized for nothing very serious, but just recently within the past few months for 3 nights, and knowing that, okay, it was still going to cost me some money, but it wasn't going to put me into bankruptcy.
Right.
You know, it's unfortunate that, and it's worse than unfortunate. That I can't imagine what it's like to have that insecurity of being one illness of one family member away from losing your home, losing a car. I mean, that's they have very valid concerns.
Which is one of my questions. How has your 9 years of listening and thinking about it, how has it changed you, Professor?
Oh my gosh, probably in so many ways. I mean, one, it's made me... I've always loved the state, clearly. You know, I went into this project because really not anticipating any of this, but because I wanted to study political understanding and wanted to spend more time in Wisconsin, right? So I've always loved the state, but it's changed me in just my profound sense of attachment to this place, and I feel as though I know it so much better, and... I'm also much more mindful of how we all can be blind to things right in our backyard unless we take the time to get outside of our normal, you know, circles of the way we live our lives and listen to people. So that has been a big change for me. I've always believed and the value of listening, but now I really understand how much you can learn when you do shut up for a minute and listen to people.
Why was it important to you to grant anonymity, both to the individuals who you quote, because you went there with a tape recorder, and secondly, even to the communities where you gathered these quotes?
I wanted people to feel comfortable talking with me, and I think some of them literally, you know, they said, I don't care if you tell people who I am, but just my ethic as a researcher is that people shouldn't be at risk of anything for sharing their opinions with me. So, I wanted to protect them from other just people criticizing them for their own views or somehow holding it against them. And I kept the identity of these communities private because in some places people might be able to, figure out who so-and-so was or said this or that. And to be honest, there were some conversations where they were so private that I didn't include them in the book because I just made a judgment about, this might come back around to somebody and they shouldn't, why have them face that kind of retribution. So.
Do you think if they had, since they had anonymity, they may have overstated their anger, outrage? Oh. No, I'm going to use your term, resentment.
I don't think so.
Okay.
I think if anything, it was understated because, you and I know each other well enough now to, I'm a super nice person. I'm female. And I'm a guest to their group. And for the most part, even as divisive as our lives in Wisconsin are right now, Wisconsinites are very kind people, is my sense. And so given all that, and the fact that I still heard the resentment that I did, and that people, criticized faculty at UW-Madison when I had just given them a business card, multiple times over years, I think the resentment may actually be much more intense than I heard in person.
Wow. Yeah. How do you explain this, what I'm calling, what's the matter with Kansas, contradictions? Two quotes. Even the folks missing teeth rarely supported government-sponsored health care reform. That's from 145. Even though they perceive that their towns are about to dry up and blow away, they want government to just leave them alone. How do you explain these contradictions, Professor?
Yeah. The explanation to me is that there's this sense that government, whatever it's doing, clearly is not doing things right, and it's not doing things to help our community. You know, so even though an outside observer might say, but why don't you want Obamacare, right? You clearly need health care. Why wouldn't you want that? Or why wouldn't you want a government program that's going to do this or that in your community? That people perceive, you know, they've heard it before. They've heard the government say we're raising taxes to fix this or that. And they look at their communities on sort of this constant decline, and they look at their own struggle to make ends meet, and they think, I'm not buying it. Why? You know, I'm not raising my taxes so that you can go create some government program that's not going to help people like me.
Does that resentment extend to all layers of government, city, village, town, counties, state government, and federal government, Professor?
It depended on the group. So a lot of times, I was surprised to find we'd be talking about government for maybe several years. And then someone would say, well, since, you know, I've been serving on the county board, you know, someone in the group would be an elected official. And they, you know, again, it depended on the group. Some people would say, well, at the county level, thank goodness we can get things done. Or here in this town, we can get things done. But even then, sometimes public officials themselves are saying, I know, it's all, you know, a whole bunch of hogwash, or, you know. So it varied. And it's a little bit hard to generalize across all levels of government, but it does cut across many levels of government where people, you know, have this. This is overgeneralizing a bit, but there is the lack of trust in government is pretty widespread. It's definitely aimed toward the federal government, and a lot of times at the state government, that varied a bit too, depending on how people felt about their local state legislators. But there, you know, there's a, to put it in probably the most general sense, there's a sense that democracy is broken.
And I want to get to that later, but I didn't plan this, but on Monday I'm working, doing my job in the Capitol press room.
Yeah.
When former Senator Bob Jauch comes in to say hi.
Oh, wow.
He represented half of northern Wisconsin for 28 years in the Senate. He's told me this twice. He's very much looking forward to reading your book.
Oh, wow.
When I showed it to him in a couple segments,
he
said, let me think about that. Is it possible that Professor Kramer talked to what he called the professional gripers in the coffee shops? And here's what he said, and I want to ask you to respond to it. There are some professional gripers, maybe they're retired, and they don't have the time to talk to you, whereas most people holding down one or two jobs, and then his example, who are also volunteer firefighters in rural areas, don't have the time to talk to you.
Yeah.
Do you? Could he have a point?
Sure. And it goes back to my point earlier that, you know, what I heard is not necessarily a scientific cross-section of Wisconsin, right? But I think that's discounting these folks too quickly. So, yes, we have this stereotype of, you know, the grumpy old men.
Yep. You talk
bluntly
about those. Page 39. Some of the people I learned the most from were consistently grumpy. Excuse me.
Yeah. But, you know, that actually doesn't characterize all the people that I talked to. So most of the groups of people were not all retired people. Many people were on their way to work. Right. Many times it was men as well as women. I talked to younger people. I found private groups of people who weren't sort of in the place where everybody knows people are meeting up. And so I think the griping is very common, and it's not, you know, exclusive to four people in town. And I talk to a lot of busy people who, you know, go get coffee at 5:30 so they can get to their job at 6:30. It's not that these are people with a lot of time on their hands. Oftentimes, and actually I would say the default person in these groups was a small business owner, very well kind of networked in town, knew a lot of people, involved in a lot of things, and it was important to them to sort of get the daily news in their community. So yeah, some of them professional gripers for sure, but some of them, a lot of them were that, like, they were local opinion leaders.
You say in your book at one point, you went out of your way to talk to more women, number one,
yeah.
And number two, more young people.
Right.
And you picked up members of 4-H.
Right.
Well, is that saying then that you have a concern that you over-interviewed white, retired white men?
For a time, I was worried about that, yeah. Yeah, but that's why I went and found other groups.
Do you think you'd find the same rural anger and resentment if you'd gone to rural areas of Iowa, northern Minnesota?
Yes.
So do you have a feeling for whether our rural resentment or rural consciousness mm-hmm. is more or less pronounced than in some of those other states?
I don't know about that. I do know that my sense is that it does exist in other places, and I haven't done the field work in other places to know for sure, but I'm struck by almost every time I give a talk, someone will come up and say, that sounds just like Wyoming. Oh my gosh, or that sounds just like Idaho, or that's New York State. Did you do some of your field work in New York State? I mean, so other people just anecdotally will say it sounds very familiar. But I think now, just watching this presidential campaign, I also think it's a microcosm of a broader national thing where those of us in the heartland have a similar kind of resentment toward the coast, right? Who gets all the attention? Who gets all the resources? Whether we're talking about the attention from the presidential campaigns or from the national news media, there's, you know, writ large on the national stage is sort of a similar thing where we feel overlooked a lot of times. We hear more about snowstorms in New Jersey than we do about Wisconsin, right?
Yeah. Page 26 of your book, let's come back to this. You say your research left you with a deep concern for democracy, not only in Wisconsin, but in the United States. Can you elaborate on that, please?
Sure. The thing that concerns me most is the way this undertone of resentment can be tapped into by politicians. And the most effective way, it seems, to tap into it is by saying, you are right, you're not getting your fair share, and these folks are, and pointing the finger of blame at another population group. And in my mind, that's a recipe for disaster. And we're seeing it, you know, we're seeing it in real time now. Whether it's in the presidential campaign and sort of the animosity that's been fomented against immigrants or Muslims, whether, you know, one example close to home right here in Wisconsin was the incident at Elkhorn girls varsity soccer match not that long ago, right, when elementary school girls shouting things at the opposing team. And I'm not even going to repeat it. I should probably stop retelling that story because it's so awful. But that is what bothers me. You can't truly, I mean, if democracy is really about us governing each other, yes, we elect people to do that job for us most of the time, but at some level, it's about us making choices that impact one another. How are we going to do that in a humane way if we're constantly reminding each other and being reminded that some people are less deserving than others?
What's the worst case scenario if this anger and this resentment continues, Professor, for democracy?
That our campaigns are about ethnocentrism and about pitting, you know, people against other people in the population, and that our policy arguments are made to us on the backs of other people as opposed to on the merits of how it's going to make us all better off in the end. To me, that's there's probably a worser case scenario than that, but to me, that's bad as it is.
And then my final question, do you plan to continue to listen to some of these people that in rural Wisconsin
that you
heard for 5 years?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I'm not quite sure how I'm going to negotiate the time to do that, but I can tell you just in the few trips I've made in the past few months since the book was published to deliver copies to folks, I mean, it's delightful. It's delightful and a luxury to have the time to sit down with people and say, tell me what's going on around here these days. And every time I go, I learn something new. And so I do feel a kind of duty to keep listening.
Well, Professor Kathy Kramer, thanks for your energy expended for leaving, you know, the hallowed halls of UW-Madison and going around Wisconsin for 5 years. And thanks for talking about the politics of resentment with Wisconsin High.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.